Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello and good afternoon, everybody. I'd like to welcome Mr. Hank Thomas. He is the CEO and the co-founder of Strategic Cyber Ventures. They're out in the Washington, D.C. area. Hank, thank you for your time and welcome to our show this afternoon.
No, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. Looking forward to the discussion.
Well, I know your time is very valuable, so thank you once again. Now, we looked at your bio, and you seem to have a very deep and rich background in, well, cybersecurity, Security 19 in general. Could you tell us some more about the highlights of your career, please?
Sure. Yeah, no, I started off as an Army intelligence officer, doing very tactical kind of intelligence work in the Army, transitioned to more electronic warfare-related stuff, and eventually cyber warfare-related stuff through my time working at the National Security Agency as an Army officer. Then spent about a decade in the consulting world at a company called Booz Allen Hamilton, where I spent a big part of that time on the federal side working with national level security agencies, and then the other half of that time working on the commercial side, building Fortune 1000 security programs. And just over 4 years ago, came up with the idea to start an early stage venture capital firm focused solely on cybersecurity, and been doing that for 4 years. And now we started a new company called SCVX, which is making much larger investments in the cybersecurity space.
Okay, now how do you venture into both of these companies? How do you start up one and all of a sudden decide to go into another one? What was your catalyst, your motivation? Factors, and are these companies that you've helped create, obviously?
Yeah, so when we started SCV, essentially, we raised a $100 million fund to invest in early-stage cybersecurity companies, and we've invested in about one a year for 4 years, which in the venture capital world is a pretty slow pace, but we have a very unique arrangement with our investors where we're kind of only investing in things that we can get super passionate about and feel like we can provide a lot of value add at Strategic Cyber Ventures. And about this time last year, we were looking at what our next investment might be and on the early stage side. And we found ourselves constantly in this conversation about how quickly the cybersecurity industry is consolidating and how highly fragmented it has become. And we learned about a new vehicle called a vehicle that's been around for a while, but one that's never been used in the cyber world before, called a special purpose acquisition company. And once I spent the time to learn about what that was, it looked like a really, really cool financial tool to build a very, very interesting technology, 2.0 technology cybersecurity platform, while sort of riding this consolidation wave that we felt like was happening in cyber.
Okay, excellent. So are you running both now, SBC? SCV while you're running SCVX also?
Yeah, that's right. So we put up all the risk capital to create SCVX. We are what's called the SPAC parlance. We are the sponsor of SCVX, which is a separate company. And I didn't have, I realized we needed somebody with sort of deeper, broader Wall Street experience dealing with publicly traded companies, because SCVX is a publicly traded company listed on the New York Stock Exchange that's hunting for large acquisitions. So we hired a CEO named Mike Doniger to be the CEO of SCVX, and I gave myself the title of CTO, and I'm also co-founder and the primary investor in the company.
Okay. Now, how long have both of these entities been in business?
So SCV has been around for 4 years, and SCVX, we formed it in the fall of 2019, and we IPO'd SCVX on the New York Stock Exchange on the 24th of January.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Wow. Congratulations. I'm sure that's a big monumental achievement. You're the first guest I've had that actually has debuted their company like that, so it's honored. It's really an honor and privilege. I didn't know that.
Yeah, that's the uniqueness of this vehicle. It's very complicated. You know, we essentially went out and raised $230 million, on our roadshow, and now we're sitting on $230 million in cash and access to essentially, it sounds crazy, but actually essentially up to $1.5 billion in additional capital through something that's called a PIPE, which is a private investment in a public entity. And we are, you know, so we're listed on New York Stock Exchange. We're a company with whose only operations are to find another company to acquire. And so as soon as we find another company to acquire with this cash that we raised tied to our thesis you know, that we can get into more further if you're interested in around cybersecurity, as soon as we acquire that company, it will reverse merge into our entity, and our stock ticker on the New York Stock Exchange will change from our current ticker, which is SCVX, to whatever ticker that company decides to have. And so it's essentially a fast track to IPO for another company. And, you know, we're looking for the right ingredients to make for that, to find that interesting company.
Okay. Now, one thing I just want to clarify for our audience. So you're not really a cybersecurity company that offers, like, you know, like products. And so you're strictly venture capitaling into cybersecurity, right?
Yeah. So SCV invests, you know, we generally take 15 to 20% stakes in early stage companies and then help them grow.
Okay.
So they're the ones that actually provide the products or services, generally products. And with SCVX, we were essentially reverse finding a company to reverse merge with, and that company provides the products and services. And so yes, you don't really come to SCV or SCVX for products or services. You can come to us to look at our portfolio to see what's in it for products and services. We can help you direct you towards those, but we don't deliver those ourselves. You know, we're essentially we're an investment firm.
Gotcha. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
Now, what's your target company that you're trying to profile when you make venture capital decisions like that? Now, I do have an MBA, and I kind of took a course in this area. I mean, I'm nowhere near an expert at it, but we did a case study like a class project. Okay, you're a venture capitalist, and what would you look at when you invest into a company? So, like, what do you look at when you invest into a cybersecurity company or tech company? Like, what are the key indicators, or like, what are you giving key criteria that might be useful for our audience?
Yeah.
You might even be looking for some kind of investors too.
Yeah, so everybody kind of has their own investment thesis, and ours goes a little bit something like this. And it took us, you know, a little bit of time to kind of narrow into what our sweet spot is. And we have an investment committee that helps, you know, help us formulate what this looks like. But on the venture capital side, we look for cybersecurity product companies, so meaning it's software based, that may have a services component to it, but the product is the primary focus of what it is they're monetizing. We like to say that we like product to be 75% of what their offering is, and maybe there's some services wrapped around that. We look for companies that have – we don't go super early seed stage investing. We do generally later seed stage or Series A investing, meaning that the company – we've set a threshold that the company must have at least $250 million in – or sorry, not million, $250,000 in annual recurring revenue. We look for companies that are based here in the U.S. or have a significant U.S. presence. We have one Israeli company in our portfolio, but they have a U.S. presence. We know how difficult it is for early stage companies already. And so to help a company, you know, maybe come across the pond and set up a shop here is something that maybe somebody else could help them do, but it's, you know, it'd be too much for the scope of our team to be successful with. And then, so U.S. presence, and we look for a company that has excellent customers. So they may only have $250,000 in annual recurring revenue, but we look at the quality of the customers that they have. Maybe it's only two, and so that we can talk to those customers and learn about why they chose that product. Those are just some examples of the types of things we look for in early stage cybersecurity technology companies.
Okay. Now, do you invest primarily in U.S.-based companies, or have you invested, like overseas startup companies? Like, there's a plethora of them, China, Russia. There's some, India, I know, that really are growing up there, Australia. Do you invest overseas like that? And if so, what regions do you focus on?
Yeah. We primarily focus on the U.S. just because it's the world's biggest market, and there's primarily that's the for cybersecurity product companies to sell into, the U.S. is definitely the world's biggest market to sell into. Now, our very first investment was in an Israeli company called Trapex Security, who has deception technology. They already had a U.S. presence. But all of our other, our focus is primarily on, the U.S., Israel, which has a major center of gravity when it comes around, tech startups with a specific emphasis on cybersecurity, startups, Western Europe, Australia, is where we primarily focus. We do not do any business in China or with Chinese or Chinese companies for security reasons, and same with Russia. We don't do any business in Russia with Russians or with Russian companies.
Okay. In the U.S., I was actually kind of surprised that the U.S. is actually the biggest market for cybersecurity companies. I thought Asia, you know, like India and Australia were the biggest ones, so that really shed some light here. Here in the United States, like, what is the geographic region? Has it been mostly the Bay Area? I know that, you know, like Texas and some of the southern states are really getting hot with the technology also, and there's some startups that are coming there too. Because I'm writing a book right now on artificial intelligence and cybersecurity, and there are a lot of, you know, these tech startups in, like, in the Austin area that are starting to come up, especially in the way of AI and machine learning. Have you done any work there, or where do you like to specialize in terms of geography here in the U.S.?
Yeah, we are geographic agnostic, but obviously the major centers of gravity you just listed are where we spend a lot of time hunting for cool new companies and teams and technology. The Bay Area being the largest, although, you know, that's changing a bit, where a lot of companies are moving out of the Bay Area to other places. We like to kind of hunt in non-traditional areas, the Midwest, the Washington, D.C. area where we are, is a major center of gravity for early stage cybersecurity companies. Really anywhere in the world that has a kind of a tap into military talent and security service talent, like Israel, like the U.K. and Western Europe, like the Washington, D.C. area. You have a lot of people that have been living in the trenches of cybersecurity. They come up with great ideas to build cybersecurity products, and we like to go to those places. The Bay Area is a little bit different. They have just general technology talent, a lot of which has been, you know, been involved in enterprise cybersecurity for some time. Austin, Texas, clearly has a large, sort of city-state of incubator of talent. And Boston area has a lot of tech talent. Manhattan does as well. So, we like to make enough noise and be enough of a draw to young entrepreneurs that they sort of seek us out, and we don't really care where they are. They could be in, New Orleans, Louisiana. It wouldn't make a difference to us as long as they have very interesting technology and an interesting management team.
So what do you consider an interesting technology or product? Have you done anything with AI or IoT? Because those are some of the big things right now, you know, in cyber.
Yeah. Yeah. Some interesting areas for us are things that aren't necessarily crowded categories in cyber. Over the last two decades, essentially, cybersecurity, for like it or not, for what's worth, has kind of been in retreat, which is not a good place to be when you're in the security business. We've sort of retreated from the perimeter to the endpoint, and now people are starting to look at they're saying, like, we can't really build higher walls or deeper moats on the edge of our network or in depth all the way to the endpoint. None of this has really, really worked. So what are some other things we can do to essentially limit the adversary's ability to gain a foothold on our network and then move laterally and do bad things? So how do we find the bad guy quicker, assuming that they're going to get in if they're persistent enough? And this goes to the sort of zero trust model you hear about a lot these days. I like to call it, intrusion suppression. So meaning like, you know, there are going to be intrusions, but how do you minimize the damage? So some areas we've invested in are things like deception technology that can fool an adversary into doing things that attacking targets that they think are real. But in meantime, in parallel, they're also disclosing their location, and you're allowed to kind of, it provides a early warning to an adversary on your network. We've invested in behavioral analytics technology, which kind of goes to the AI machine learning type of technology that you were mentioning. And right. The way that essentially works is it looks for anomalous behavior on your network. It figures out what normal looks like, and then starts to alert you to anomalous behavior on your network based on what, you know, it's trained to realize what normal looks like. And so it takes some fine tuning to kind of get you there so that you don't have a high false positive rate, but that's a very hot space in cyber. There's a lot of things that help security teams, because security is, you know, artificial intelligence is great, but it's Fortune 1000 companies, specifically financial services industry, take the top 10 banks in the world. There is no AI smart enough right now that a bank is going to allow AI to make like security decisions for it that don't involve human interaction, because, you know, the bank is not going to allow AI to shut down a global network of banks based off a computer making that decision. Like we're interested in, it can help like computers and AI assisted security technology can help manual security teams make better decisions, but they're not making independent decisions on their own quite yet. AI is still a little bit too artificial to be, you know, a sole decision maker yet. Yeah.
Well, I know some of the other big topics are like the certified maturity, that's the CMMC. I'm probably getting the actual name mixed up, but the CMMC, I don't know if you're familiar with that. Another one that, you know, some of the other bigger topics are like blockchains, you know, crypto jacking, and just like data privacy compliance. Have you done any investing in those kinds of companies? Because I know that there are a lot of cyber companies out there that they do like compliance auditing, especially when it comes to like the GDPR and the CCPA. That's a big thing right now, and a lot of companies just don't want to, you know, have be penalized so much if they're not in compliance. Have you invested in those kinds of companies too that are offering services to those clients?
So a lot of our types of technology, that none of them we've made investment decisions based solely off of GDPR, CMMC, or but they do aid in helping companies become compliant. Like, let's take GDPR for example. GDPR does a lot of things, but you know, one of those things is based on, you know, you having to, you know, let's just say broadly, it forces companies of a certain size to protect their customers' identities in certain ways. And most of the security tools we invest in allow security teams to find bad guys on networks. And the quicker you can find a bad guy on a network and kick them off that network, the lower the chance that the data is going to be stolen and the company is going to be in violation of a GDPR, you know, be the receiver of a GDPR fine. Blockchain is an interesting one you mentioned, just because it was very hot topic for a while that blockchain was going to be the savior of security. I have yet to see a blockchain based enterprise cybersecurity company that of scale. I mean, I know blockchain is a great way to for in certain use cases to protect and share information, and you know, and keep a, you know, have an excellent record of it, of what you're doing, of the transactions and things. But the technology itself is often too cumbersome for Fortune 1000 companies to utilize it for enterprise business operations. And I just, there was a lot of hype around it. I mean, it's very interesting, but it just hasn't really come to major fruition as a core component of enterprise cybersecurity.
Okay. Do you have any success stories you'd like to share with us? Like, you know, you've invested in a company and they've turned out this great product. You know, we've gotten the ROI and everything. Do you have any? I mean, obviously, you can't share, like, the company names and all, but in general, on a macro level that you can share, do you have any stories you'd like to share with our audience today?
Yeah, sure. I guess early on we had a company we sold to VMware, which was a bit of a surprise, but a cool learning point. That was an artificial user entity behavior analytics company. The success stories I like to tout, because we invest in early stage companies that, you know, are growing at high multiples, is the category is being involved in category creation. Like, we invest in things that generally don't really have a category in security yet. You know, if they do, it's a very early and emerging one. And we help create that category. You know, analysts at places like Forrester and Gartner may not even be talking about deception technology. And they weren't really when we invested in a deception technology company, but now it has its own category there. And, you know, when you have a category, that means you have competition. And then that means you're growing to the point where industry analysts are paying attention to you, and the market that you're in is hot enough that other people have venture-backed ideas that are, you know, forcing you to innovate and grow quicker. So category creation is probably what I'm most proud about as far as, like, the 4 years of venture capital investing we've done so far. I mean, we've been in so far as to create a company called Polarity is one of our early stage companies that still doesn't really have a category. We're calling it we've called it lots of different things: memory augmentation technology. We've called it virtual reality for your desktop. It's essentially a collaboration tool for security teams to help them swarm on very complex security topics in a more efficient way. And that's something that, frankly, did not exist beyond using things like existing tools like Microsoft Excel and other things like that. There wasn't a company that was laser focused on doing something like that until we invested in Polarity, and they've been very successful and are a category leader, if you want to call it that, for what they do now.
Okay, excellent. Now, you know, up front right now, the big hot topic is the COVID-19 coronavirus. So how do the cybersecurity company valuations look like now with what's happening right now? I go through the news headlines every evening, and I've seen some good companies, you know, raise some serious, like, we're talking $10, $20 million in VC funding because they've mm-hmm. come out with something, some kind of like tracing app or something. They've done something really well. I can't remember the names of the companies off the top of my head, but how does the investing world look like now with COVID-19 going on? Do you see any hot areas right now?
Yeah, I mean, it's cyber, you know, we were kind of waiting it out to see how it was going to impact cybersecurity. I think, you know, if you're a 2.0 technology in cyber, meaning like you're an over the horizon looking security product that is, you know, cloud native, and it's going to help people accelerate their journey, a secure journey to the cloud and operate into the cloud. And if you look at the last decade, it was the future. It was the decade of the future of work. And I think this decade is going to be the decade of the future, the security, a secure future of work, because we've put a lot of, clearly we're able to, as a society, to transition to this sort of working remote thing, even better than maybe we thought we could. Now we just need to really double down on how to secure these connections. And so if you're a technology that is in any way, shape, or involved in identity and access management, if you're involved in cloud native security, if you're involved in non-traditional threat hunting of adversaries that have figured out a way to transcend from the enterprise to attacking, you know, the cloud, you are in high demand, and valuations in security really haven't gone down that much, as much as I thought they were going to a month ago. We've seen very little impact to our portfolio. We've seen term sheets for companies we're interested in investing in companies receive multiple term sheets at very high valuations. And if anything, there's more of a demand for security. Now, if you're a legacy enterprise security product that is what's like an on-premise type product that isn't cloud native, your days may be numbered and your valuation has definitely suffered.
Okay. Now, let's go into the cyber threat landscape in general. We've been hearing about nation-state threat actors, you know, North Korea, China, Russia, and especially using, you know, with them meddling with the elections coming up here this year. It's already not, you know, trying not to get political here, but, you know, we know it's already going to be messed up enough with the COVID-19 stuff. But what are your thoughts on that? I mean, what do you feel about, you know, especially the use of deep fakes? You know, it's where a cyber attacker can, like, mimic a video of Donald Trump saying, hey, you know, donate money to my campaign, but they go to a phishing website. Have you dealt with anything like that in your line of work?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it gets very confusing, I think, for the average person that doesn't live in this world every day to say, like, you know, oh, was this information warfare? Or was this cyber warfare? What was, you know, there's really two different things. And you saw in the 2016 election, you know, and again, not to be political, but I think most people can't argue that you can't make an argument that this part did not occur. I mean, the Russians broke into a DNC server, and now what they did from there is, you know, up for debate, but they did break in, and they did so primarily to aid in an information warfare campaign designed to, at a minimum, reduce people's confidence in our own electoral process. And you know, you can, you know, layer on top of that, manipulate results of the election, things like that. And the Russians and the Chinese and authoritarian regimes and near peer adversaries like they are, have for decades, even before cyber, attempted to do this. You know, they did it with leaflets and hanging up posters with glue in Western Europe in the 1970s and the 1980s and before that. And in, you know, the Chinese do it to their own people. And there is, we have every reason to suspect that cyber enabled, both cyber attacks that could like be destructive or manipulative, but cyber enabled, meaning they can establish a foothold and then, gather information or change information to aid and abet in information warfare, which is, you know, can be done without cyber, but in this case, it's being aided by cyber. We have every reason, and there's smoking gun evidence that they're doing that to us right now, and they have been for some time. And it's a shadowy place, so they can get away with it with very low attribution. You know, they can admit nothing, deny everything, and make counter accusations and say it wasn't them. So I can tell you we're going to see more of it. And I would say when it comes to like deep fakes, it's getting easier for people to produce them. And I think we should constantly be on the lookout for a deep fake, particularly one that could have a very, very, bad reaction quickly, where, you know, if it caused like us and our military command structure to maybe, you know, launch an attack or a counterattack based off a deep fake, that we couldn't pull back from, let's call it a nuclear scenario or a cyber counterattack scenario, that could be very, very, very bad if we were to react too quickly, because we didn't have the ability to determine if something was a deep fake or not in short order.
Okay. What are your thoughts like in the Internet of Things? Because, you know, that's basically where everything is connected, you know, virtually, physically. You know, you got Siri, Siri, Cortana, blah, blah, blah. And as this work from home has now proliferated, you know, I think people, mm-hmm. companies, everybody's now starting to realize, hey, we live in a very connected world, right? I mean, if something goes down, it just leads to a cascading failure. So in that regard, like regards to a smart city or smart home, there's so many points of connection. I don't like the idea. I'm kind of an old-fashioned guy where I still drive like an old, like I drive like a Honda Civic 03 with analog instrumentation. You know, I don't like those cars, you know, where they can just, anything can go wrong with the electronics. It's scary, and I don't like this everything all being connected together. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, do you have like a smart home or a smart car, like you just clap your hands and the whole thing, you know, it backs up and drives and all that kind of neat stuff? Or
yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people look at that and say, well, if it's so easy to hack into this stuff, why hasn't there been like this major attack that shut down, you know, these quasi-smart cities we have now? Or why aren't more cars being hacked and, you know, people being driving off of cliffs and things like that? I mean, I think it comes down to capability and intent, like with most criminals and threat actors and how they make decisions. The capability is definitely there, especially for the more advanced actors to attack IT, OT, our connected world, all those connections that are associated with that. It's just the capability is there, but is the intent there? You know, I think that a lot of these networks, IT, OT networks, SCADA systems, supervisor controlled data acquisition systems, things like that, I think a lot of these, the more advanced nation state threat actors and criminal syndicates, why would they not be trying to establish a foothold in these places that they could use when they needed to use them most and when we least suspected it? Why would they not want to lay in wait on these places? And how are we sure we're actually hunting for them there to make sure that, you know, we're trying to prevent as few of these footholds by bad guys on these networks as possible, especially ones that are critical to our way of life. And increasingly we are dependent on them. And so, I think that maybe this drill we just went through with Corona, with COVID-19, was an interesting drill for something that could be a lot worse, whether it's, you know, something that's biological in nature, or if it's cyber in nature. I mean, I've always, there could be a Pearl Harbor or worse type scenario brought onto the United States by one of our near peer adversaries using an attack on IT, IoT that would be, you know, that could be catastrophic to a city, a region, if we're not prepared for it. So a lot has to, and unfortunately, cyber has really fallen to like fourth priority in the world based on what's been happening the last few months. And in reality, cyber is like the underpinning of all these things, and we really can't let it fall out of our sights as a top priority for our country as far as critical infrastructure security is concerned.
Okay. Now, what are your thoughts like, you know, as we've kind of alluded to this before, like on the compliance, the GDPR and the CCPA, I've had a number of podcasts on this, and I think people are kind of happy, unhappy with it. What are your thoughts on that? I mean, have you talked to any of your clients or companies about that? Like what their thoughts are? I mean, obviously if they're in this valuation realm of 10 to 20 million, obviously they're going to be prone to these laws and legislations that they have, you know, offices in the EU or in California. So have they talked to you about this, or have you talked about them when you negotiate a deal?
Yeah, we definitely talk about it. We usually end up being on the side of helping protect larger enterprise clients than actually being concerned about, our company is being on the receiving end of a fine, since we don't generally control a lot of data that could be finable. Now our customers are banks and retailers and healthcare systems, and we're helping them secure their enterprises, and they definitely on the potentially on the receiving end of some of these bigger fines. But you know, unfortunately, I think CCPA and GDPR and all these other ones fall into the stack of for security teams of there's real security and there's compliance. And if you're a Fortune 10 bank, let's say financial services, you know, customer of out there, you know, bank of whatever, you've got people on your security team that are actively involved in trying to block and tackle adversaries that are trying to break into their network every single day, nonstop, 24/7, 365. That's real security. Now, compliance, these checklists and things, yeah, it's obviously these were good first steps to get people focused on trying to protect consumer information and our privacy, which is, you know, a top priority. But lawmakers aren't very good at creating laws that really map to real security practices. So a lot of times you find that these large corporate entities have to hire almost a separate team just to ensure they're remaining compliant. There's a big line between sort of like the security team that does real active defense security and a team that's kind of just making sure all the boxes have check marks in them on the compliance checklist related to GDPR and other things like that.
Okay. Now, one big topic here is, you know, cybersecurity insurance policies. I've got a book contract that I'm trying to work. I'll be working on a new book next year on that. Have you dealt with cybersecurity insurance policies? Because I know that's another big hot button topic that's being talked about right now. And unfortunately, the industry is very muddled because, let's take, for example, an SMB, a small, medium-sized business. Just because they bought a policy, they think that they're protected to all degrees of a cyber attack. And when they file their claim, more than likely they may not get their entire payout for their claim. Have you dealt with companies? Have you talked to them about, you know, cyber insurance policies? And what's your take on that?
Lately, I've been seeing a lot of companies, that startups, that are trying to get into that space because it's been handled so poorly. Nobody knows how to underwrite cybersecurity insurance policies, not even the big guys. I mean, the rule book constantly seems to be thrown out when it comes to cyber, because when you constantly have a global network of adversaries working to defeat the security controls that already in place for, you know, standard enterprise security on an internet that was never really designed for security in the first place. And we've basically been playing whack-a-mole security ever since and in retreat, like I was talking about earlier, to truly underwrite all the different possible threats to vulnerabilities associated with every type of attackable cyber surface out there is a tremendous task. And so you're seeing a lot of people that are doing a lot of automated outside looking in, what's often referred to as pen testing, penetration testing, or red teaming of networks, continuous red teaming of networks tied to insurance policies or the underwriting of insurance policies based on some sort of automated analysis prior to the policy being written. So I think people are looking like two ridge lines ahead to try to figure out what the future of cyber insurance looks like, because most people that are savvy enough about this almost probably wouldn't even buy cyber insurance at this point, because it covers almost nothing when it comes to a major cyber attack, act of war, or other areas where, you know, it's a very gray area when it comes to the laws of cyber war. Who is a cyber actor and what's insurable and what's not.
Okay. Let me see here. Now, what are your plans for expansion? It sounds like your company is on a great growth trajectory with all the investments that you're doing. What are your plans for expansion?
Right now we're looking to build and an enterprise cybersecurity platform that is, you know, when you look at the publicly traded markets of cybersecurity companies, there really aren't that many large, purpose-built, publicly traded enterprise cybersecurity companies. You look at the success story of CrowdStrike over the last few years, that's an amazing company that has incredible growth story the last few years. You look at some of the other big players, and it's a pure play cybersecurity company. It was grown from the ground up as a cybersecurity company. Look at some of the other big players out there, and their core competency isn't just cyber. I mean, Microsoft is a huge cybersecurity company that does a lot of things that aren't cybersecurity. Palo Alto Networks, another big example. So we're looking to really be a force for consolidation of some of the best. I call it the Voltron model, where we're pulling together some of the best and brightest security teams and technology using the SPAC vehicle and other forcing financial vehicles, giving them a way to come together and create really interesting cybersecurity platforms that are going to allow cybersecurity decision makers like chief information security officers in the Fortune 1000 and beyond, even small and medium-sized business, allow them to look to platform security plays that provide them the ability to reduce the number of vendors they have to rely on to remain secure. I mean, if the average Fortune 1000 CISO today has over 100 security controls in their enterprise security stack. If you go to Bank of America, you'll find they have over 150 security controls just to maintain their own security. We don't think that number is going to go from 150 to 1, and there's just going to be a single pane of glass to do all your security on there, but we think it's going to go from 120 to like 50, and we think our platform will help be a big part of the platforms that we want to build will capture a lot of that business because we're going to have multi-dimensional platforms that can do more things for more security teams. And that's really what our growth looks like over the next few years. It'll be tied to that.
Okay. Sounds excellent. Now, let me see here. Talk about this cybersecurity industry consolidation. I've been reading the headlines that this consolidation is happening. There have been some buyouts, but I don't think it's like the internet bubble where it's just going to like just collapse one day. There are some buyouts. Now, what are your thoughts on that? What's driving it? Are we going to see, would you consider it to be a slow pace right now, active pace? And how do you foresee it all playing out this year and next year, especially the COVID stuff going on?
Yeah, I mean, there's no secret the M&A market's slowed down a bit, which I think is why our SCVX SPAC vehicle is so interesting to people right now, because it is a consolidating force. But yeah, I mean, it can't continue this way. I mean, it's a highly, highly fractured, fragmented market right now. I mean, you have classes of security controls that have 10, 15, 20 vendors in them, all essentially doing the same thing. None of them are profitable. They're all burning venture capital dollars at a very strong, very high rate. Many of them plateau at $10 million, $20 million in ARR. There's going to have to be consolidation in each one of those categories. It's just going to happen. And in addition, big security teams the amount of vendor relationship management they're having to do is actually adding to the fog of war, cyber war that they're in. When they have to deal with 120 different vendors, that's very time consuming. And these chief information security officers, they want to deal with less paperwork, less acquisition turmoil. They want less risk, frankly, too. They're worried. They're constantly live in fear that some of these companies they rely on are going to go out of business. So they want larger, more stable, more capable platforms on their network that's going to allow them to focus more on fighting the bad guy and less about, which vendor is guarding which avenue of approach to their network. The wave is going to pick up. You're going to see a lot of cybersecurity deals, mergers, acquisitions, consolidation, the remainder of this year and next year, mark my word on that. Even post Corona, it's actually going to accelerate.
Wow. Okay. Now suppose, someone from our audience, perhaps even me, saying, "Hey, Hank, we'd like to get some money in our company." That'd be great, obviously. How should they approach you? I mean, what's the best way that you tell a potential prospect that saying, "Hey, we'd like some money investor. For example, take you have company XYZ, and they think they've got this hot product in the cybersecurity market that's going to cure some solution like the work from home issues. How should they approach you in saying, "Hey, we need some venture capital money"? What kind of path should they take, and how should they approach you in case there's somebody really interested out there that's doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I think too many people are afraid to actually just email VCs and say, you know, here's my pitch deck. You know, here's the bottom line up front, what I'm doing. Here's a, you know, submit a smart plan where you say, like, this is who I am. This is why I'm doing this. This is my product. This is how I'm differentiated. Make it clear that you've thoroughly thought through what it is you're attempting to do, whether you have zero revenue or some revenue. And more often than not, you know, a lot of VCs, if they have scout teams, and they'll say, yeah, I'll take a meeting with you. You know, what's it to me to take 20 minutes to hear what you have to say? For us, you know, since we don't invest in companies that have zero revenue, and we only invest in essentially software companies, not services, what I stated earlier, I mean, I don't want to waste anyone's time either. So if you don't have 250K in ARR, if you're not 75% a product, and, you know, if you don't have Fortune 50 customers that I can go and talk to and hear about how awesome you are, there's very, very little chance. There's essentially no chance that my firm, SCV, is going to invest in you, because that's the approach. We're a boutique cybersecurity investment firm. We're not Bain Capital. You know, we're not Sequoia. We're not a huge venture capital firm that wants to invest in place investments in a lot of places, and then only have to be right 10% of the time. We have a thesis, a very narrow thesis that we're comfortable with, that we can get really passionate about, and we stick to it 100% of the time. Bigger VCs want a bigger shotgun blast approach. And, you know, they do more things than just security, and they do more things in security, and they have bigger funds. And you know, they should be approached, I mean, by people that have good ideas. They should, you know, the benefit goes to the bold that are willing and are persistent, you know. And a lot of times VCs like me, now where I do come in handy sometimes for people that maybe don't fit into our wheelhouse, is I'll say, hey, it looks interesting, looks really cool. Like, if I had like five funds or I had a $1 billion fund, I'd probably invest in this, but I don't. But I have friends that do those sorts of things, and, you know, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this, but I will float this to a friend of mine, see if they're interested. And if they are, I'll make an introduction for you. You know, because everybody has time as money, right? And so I think, you know, at a minimum, if you don't live in the Bay Area, you know, most American entrepreneurs probably don't know a venture capitalist. It seems like everybody in the Bay Area does know a VC and, like, you know, thinks they're best buddies with all of them. Outside of that, you know, if you're in like Cleveland, Ohio or something, you probably don't know any VCs. Even here in DC, you don't know any VCs. You know, most people don't. But go to their website, look for their contact information, hit them up on LinkedIn. People do it to me all the time. I mean, I don't have time to respond to everybody, but sometimes somebody says something compelling enough that I'm like, all right, I'll listen to you for 15 minutes. And who knows what comes of those types of conversations.
Okay. Now, okay, there's this image that venture capitalists, you know, they're just out there for 2 or 3 months. Now, please don't take offense to this or anything. You know, that, you know, they just want a return your money back quickly without, you know, with a higher rate of return. But are there, like, the softer kind of VCs, where they call, like, what's the angel investors? What do you recommend more for the SMB, even for someone like myself? I mean, obviously, I'm not at that point, you know, where I can probably qualify for your company, I'll be honest, you know, for your kind of funding. But for, like, an SMB, what do you recommend? You know, I mean, if they don't want to, like, get loans from family, which is understandable, but they want to get, like, someone just to invest in them, you know, that's going to be kind of like a partner and kind of, you know, take time with it, not really, you know, kind of like breathe down their neck. Where's the money? Where's the return? What do you recommend? Is it more like an angel investor? Or is there any investor that kind of exists?
In Silicon Valley, in San Francisco, in the Bay Area, or in places like New York. So where there's the ecosystems that you mentioned to start off this podcast are successful because they have a full spectrum investor network associated with them. There are investors that invest in the angel investors, like you were describing them, all the way to the Sequoias of the world, and everything in between. There's a fully mature ecosystem in the Bay Area for that. There's nothing like it in the world. There's nothing like it in Europe. There's nothing like it in China. I mean, it crushes everything in the world. I mean, there is nowhere else in the world that has that kind of investor ecosystem that even compares to what's happening in the Bay Area. But there are a little, and so, you know, just like you reach out to a big VC, you reach out to an angel investor, and you're going to have to you're going to have to date a lot of frogs before you find one that's willing to kind of talk to you. And this is part of the drill. Like, you're going to get really frustrated because you're going to be like, hey, I'm trying to build my company, but every day I have to talk to four different angel investors or VCs, and that's sucking up all my time. Well, my advice to you is sleep less, because that's exactly what you're going to have to do until you find the right person, like, through hustle, that's going to want to be that kind of partner for you. I mean, if you're hot enough, you know, you can draw, you can be in the captain's chair a bit more and begin to pick which one, you know, you want. You know, you find the right angel investor, they're going to get you to a point where your company's growing, helping you grow fast enough that you'll have more term sheets coming your way than, you know, I'm not saying the angel investor is going to get you there alone, like, but that capital could be the accelerant you need to get to that next level. So it's just reaching out, being persistent, and sleeping less. I mean, that's really what it comes down to.
Okay. Now, as we wrap up our show here, what do you think the biggest cyber threats are going to be this year going into next year? I mean, do you think COVID is still going to be the big thing? I mean, we're talking like Zoom bombing, work from home issues. Minus the COVID ID stuff, what do you think is going to be the big hot topic? In my view, I think, you know, phishing, ransomware are still going to be the oldies but goodies, but they're going to be much more sophisticated variants on those themes. Then I think attacks to critical infrastructure is going to be another big one. In my opinion, I think we can see another 9/11 style attack. You know, not necessarily where planes are crashing into buildings, but where a cyber attack can literally shut down the water supply for weeks, the electrical grid. And I actually read an article on that, and I posted that on my cybersecurity forum. You know, if we are so poor in prepping for the COVID ID for a pandemic, how are we going to handle like a true national disaster like that? You know, where basically what we take for granted is just shut down for weeks. I mean, like, what are your thoughts on that? And what do you think is going to be the biggest threat here, like going in this year, now that we're almost like halfway through the year and going in next year?
Yeah, I mean, my biggest, what keeps me up at night, you know, if I was in a national security role, you know, trying to keep our military, trying to have an unmatched capability militarily in the world. You know, we now 10 years ago, we did not have near peer rivals that could come close to us on the battlefield. In one decade, we now have this adversary called China, which we've been sort of dying a death by a thousand cuts with the stealing of our intellectual property, and with the facilitating their colonization of our networks. And more importantly, we now fight on a battlefield that is part virtual, not just kinetic. And weapons, world-class cyber weapons are not hard to obtain. You don't even have to build them yourself. You can go and buy them on the internet. Some cases you go buy one the NSA or the CIA built on the internet. And we're now facing near-peer adversaries that in cyberspace don't follow the same laws that we do as a Western-style democracy. They don't care about those laws. They don't care about international norms. And if China wanted to invade invade Taiwan, I'm very concerned that a China could shut down something like the U.S. Transportation Command and prevent the U.S. military from responding in a timely fashion to get there to defend Taiwan from a China, because China has the ability. You know, I don't know. I don't have any inside knowledge on this, but if I was China, I'd be targeting U.S. Transportation Command. I'd be targeting U.S. Pacific Command. I'd be targeting our ability to react to something like an invasion of a place that they want to invade with tanks and infantry and naval forces. And that, just like there are cyber-enabled information warfare that's happening on our elections, which I would say is a threat to our democracy, is number two. Direct to your question, there would be a cyber-enabled invasions of countries by targeting our over-reliance on cyber for command and control of our own military forces. And it's something we need to be very concerned about. We still have the world's strongest cyber capability, but it's not that much stronger to our near peer adversaries as it compares to our ability to overmatch them with fighter planes and tanks and ships and all those things. We still dominate, but in cyber, bad guys are almost as good as we are.
Okay. Now, finally, as you wrap up our show, what do you tell your friends, family, colleagues, business prospects, and the people that you invest in? Do you have a laundry list of some items that you tell people how to protect themselves from cyber attack? Now, my mantra is we all are at risk, right? No matter how much we do, we can always get hacked into. But what can we do to help mitigate that risk, to have that proactive mindset? What do you tell people in general?
Yeah, I think, just like we look for cyber products that make it as transparent as possible to the end user, so that the end user doesn't even really know that there's this cloak of security around them. They don't have to click on things to patch things and download things. You've got to bring some level of cyber hygiene is the biggest issue in cybersecurity. This is from enterprise cybersecurity to the security of the Department of Defense, to our critical infrastructure, all down to your home network. It really comes down to basic cyber hygiene. It's the number one threat vector into networks of all sizes is through email. It's through people clicking on spear phishing emails and giving an adversary fileless malware, but clicking on something and giving an adversary a foothold onto your network. Mm. So basic cyber hygiene, paying attention to what you're clicking on, who's sending you emails, reading things, making sure that you have basic security on your home network, making sure that you have basic security installed on your endpoint devices. Most people in today's world, for whatever reason, think that stuff comes baked on their computers and things already, and it's not. For the most part, and you need to do just a little bit to make sure that you are practicing basic cyber hygiene. And I think there are many resources out there to help you figure out what those basic things are. You just Google it and then start doing some of them.
Okay. Well, Hank, we thank you for your time for this afternoon. We value it very much. I think gave some really good insight. In fact, it's the first podcast I've had where we talk about, venture capital funding into cybersecurity firms. It's been a true honor and privilege. And thanks for your time.
No, absolutely. Thank you.
And take care.
All right. Bye-bye.